Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Jennifer Law, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Welcome to Venus Rising. I'm really excited about my guest today. Barry Stevens is with us. Barry is a Toronto documentary filmmaker and a screenwriter. And I think it's pretty cool that he won a Drama Gemini Award for The Diary of Evelyn Lau, starring Sandra Oh in her first role. And then he switched to nonfiction as a writer on the international Emmy-winning documentary Jerry and Louise. An early film he directed, which is how I came to know about Barry and his work, was called Offspring. And it was about his own personal search for his sperm donor. And that film has been seen in 61 countries and has won several awards and was even nominated for an Emmy. Well done, Barry. His most recent film, which I haven't seen and I hope to see, is called The World's Biggest Family, about the problems with anonymous sperm donation. He is active in the donor-conceived communities and hoping to change laws around donor anonymity. I first met Barry about 10 years ago when I interviewed him for my film, Anonymous Father's Day, which also features the stories of donor-conceived people. So it's good to connect with you again, Barry, and thank you for joining us on Venus Rising today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my daughter married a Canadian from Toronto, so I have a soft spot in my heart for Canada, especially the Toronto area. So let's just get started, because a lot of our audience perhaps hasn't heard of you or maybe doesn't know about your work. I hope they've seen your films, or at least my film, Anonymous Father's Day. But as a ex-pediatric nurse, I like telling stories, especially about young people and how they found out about who they are and how they came to be. And tell our listeners sort of your story of how you found out how you were conceived.
I was much younger. It was, God knows, must be half a century ago almost. And my father had died in an accident very suddenly. And my mother was pretty unhappy, and she decided to tell us, me and my sister. And it was a shock. It was kind of an empty feeling, an odd feeling, just a surprise. I guess when you're a teenager, you think, wow, that's cool. Anything that makes you a bit different or cool is kind of interesting, you know, it's kind of a bonus. So I thought it was very interesting. I regretted not being able to talk to my dad about it, especially because he was a pretty distant fellow. I was born in England, and my parents were English, and that was pretty common in my generation in that country. But there was he used to walk a few steps behind the family when we were out on holiday or something. He always used to do that. Later on, when I discovered a brother through donor insemination, his dad also did the same thing. There was something about his, not my dad, and maybe David's dad, not feeling that they were fully the father. And so they didn't perhaps fully inhabit the role of father. And that was a loss for me and for him, I think. So I was sorry about that. Yeah.
And why do you think your mother decided to tell you after your father died? I mean, did you feel like this is a dirty secret she carried along and she wasn't going to carry it anymore? Or did she feel like
that? Did I feel that? No, I didn't feel that at all.
No, she feel that.
I think she just felt the burden of a secret. A psychiatrist that she went to see after my dad died, because she was depressed. He told her that the kids knew, they knew something, you know, there's always a feeling in a family. Actually, that's not true for me. I was dumb enough not to have any sense of that at all, except my father was quite distant. So it made sense. But no, I didn't suspect anything. I think also I have to say that carrying a secret like that is isolating. Secrets can be fun, you know, they're like, oh, I have this special secret, it's just mine. But they can also, the other side of that is they can also be quite lonely. And a big thing like that, I think, made her feel lonely. So I think she wanted to tell. I should say that it's a very different world. It may be even difficult for your listeners to understand how different 1950s, or my sister was conceived in the 40s, in the United Kingdom was. It's another world. It's another world. You could go back to like Louisiana in 1863. I mean, it's like a different world. And the thing was, is that when the people who arranged for my conception, a woman doctor called Dr. Mary Barton and her husband, Berthold Wiesner, they published in the British Medical Journal in 1945 what they had been doing. One of the things Wiesner mentioned is it's possible to get 20,000 babies a year from a single man, technically. And there was an outcry. Parliament was furious. The House of Lords, which is a senior house in the British Parliament, which has a lot of dukes and stuff in it. And of course, they all depend, their power depends upon inheritance, paternal inheritance. So they didn't like the idea of sperm donation. It was labeled as adultery. They discussed criminalizing it and putting my parents, people like my parents, in prison. The Archbishop of Canterbury, who's head of the Anglican Church, condemned it as a something about the devil and Beelzebub, I forget. But oddly enough, my dad was actually, for a while, his physician. But at any rate, that's the climate. And so they were told, my parents were told, absolutely keep that secret, never tell anybody. And that climate of secrecy, and of course, anonymity of who the sperm provider was, persisted long after it was necessary. I can see why it was necessary. We would have been labeled bastards, illegitimate, which was actually meant something back then, you know. You're a product of an unmarried couple. That was bad. So, plus the whole thing involves masturbation. You know, there's so many ways in which it was awful back then. So, but that climate of secrecy and anonymity persisted for, well, up to now, although it's getting a lot better.
I'm curious, did your sister, I mean, you both were told, I'm assuming at the same time, your mother sat you down.
Yeah.
I mean, and you had a relationship that was distant from your father. She probably had a different relationship, maybe still distant. I don't know. Fathers and daughters and fathers and sons have different relationships. Did you have different experiences being dropped, you know, this bomb in your lap post losing your father?
You know, I don't really know what that moment was like for my sister. And you're right. Of course, she had a better relationship with him than I did. So I don't know what it felt like for her in that moment. But later on, much later on in the 1990s, she had a bit of a health scare. She began to wonder about genetics. I mean, you couldn't get a BRCA1 test. I asked about this. You couldn't get a BRCA1 test unless you could demonstrate you were either an Ashkenazi Jew or your parent, there was a family history. So there were real disadvantages to not knowing. And she was curious about it. Plus, she had a daughter by then, and she wanted to tell her more about her heritage. So she said, well, let's find out. I said, Janice, you can never find out. You'll never find out. Forget it. I decided long ago it was hopeless. We'd never know. So I just kind of tried to forget it.
And you were from the same donor, your sister and you?
Well, that's another story, because we did try to, she tried to find out more. And we contacted a well-known donor-conceived personal. He doesn't use that phrase. His name's Bill Cordray. He's a great guy. And he put us in touch with a fella in England, David Gollance, who was also conceived through artificial insemination. He came from the same clinic. She was about the only doctor doing it in England, possibly in Europe, maybe one of two. So he came from the same clinic. He's about my age. So we all did a genetic test, and lo and behold, this guy was my brother. And it was great because I didn't have a brother, and we had a lot in common, and we just, you know, talked a lot, had the same sense, dark sense of humor. So we were just getting along. And it also said that Janice, my sister, was my full sister. She came from the same donor. So then I started looking for the donor. This is when I made a film that you have seen, Offspring. And it's a detective story. I was searching for this guy. After satisfying myself, by the way, that I wouldn't be ruining it for other couples. There are some offspring of, gamete providers who are against the whole process, who just think it's wrong totally. I don't. And I didn't want to mess it up for other parents by going searching for a you know, sperm provider and not, So I found out that just up the road from you in Berkeley, California, that there was a sperm bank of California, a lesbian collective, which had identifiable donors. The offspring could know who their biological father was when they reached 18. I discovered Sweden had done this. So I just thought, well, the heck with this, I'm going to look. So I did. And it was a lot of searching, a lot of writing, finding out who this, the doctor and her husband, how they found their sperm providers, who they were, chasing down them or their offspring, getting them to do a DNA test. And it was quite a job. In the end, we thought it was this guy, Visna, who was the husband of the doctor. But Janice could not be his daughter. And since the first DNA analyst had decided that Janice was my full sister, then I was excluded as well. But that turned out to be wrong. Janice was not my full sister. She came from a different donor, who we also discovered who he was. And Wiesner, this Bertolt Wiesner, an Austrian Jewish guy who published that article saying you could get 20,000 babies from one man, was my and David's biological father. And what's more, he had, we calculate, at least 400, maybe 1,000 children. He was active from probably the late 30s, but certainly the early 40s up until the late 60s. And they were, that was their practice. They did it every week, you know, and he was the donor for, I don't know, maybe 2/3 of all the children they produced.
Wow. And how many siblings, half-siblings, have you and Janice found and Bill?
David and I have found, I think I've identified, I think it's 44, but our calculation of a much larger number is based on a number of things, the bits of evidence and paper trail they left. Various other bits of evidence. So I'm confident that that's probably, you know, 10% or maybe as little as 5% of the total. But yeah, so we found 44 or so, I think. And I have relationships with 30 something of them. And they, of course, because we're all pretty old, we have children. Some of us even have grandchildren. So there's about 140 something relatives that have come out of this so far. We get a new one every couple of months.
Now, you're one of the, sperm donation's been around a long, long, long time. So you're not one of the early ones. There was many, many more before you.
How many? Do you know that? I mean, of course, 1884, we know about that story.
Yeah.
But it didn't, my understandings didn't really take off until the 30s, the 1930s. So I was born in 52, my sister 47.
But you have the advantage of sort of being in this space for decades versus the kids that are 10 and, you know, 20 years old, 30 years old. And we now have what we call the donor-conceived community.
Yes.
What is the donor-conceived community? Are they a lobbying bloc? Are they a coalition? Are they a... You guys are all this one big family reunion people that work collectively.
Well,
you're like your own new demographic.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a big difference between the kids who are discovering their half siblings through the donor sibling registry, which I'm sure your listeners know about, or DNA tests. Or in fact, the sperm banks have now been setting up registries and stuff because they know the game is up. And so there, I think the kids are different. They're in the process of, well, what does this mean? You know, this larger family, some of them are delighted to find half siblings and some maybe don't care so much. I don't know. It's like any family really, but it is family. I think people do feel this means something. There's very few people who would say, doesn't mean anything. Genetics doesn't mean a damn thing. The fact that you look exactly like me and hold your fork in the same way, or you read the same books and we've never met. You know, that's not the experience that it doesn't mean anything is rare. Among my cohort, we all are very aware of similarities, and we spend a lot, just this morning, spending time on WhatsApp chatting and have reunions and so forth. And we don't all get along. I mean, there's political debates, and that's always bad. That always means somebody's stomping out. But yeah, there's a real sense of family. But that really wasn't your question. Your question was donor conceived people at large. Well, I wish we were more of a lobbying group, and we're trying to do that in Canada. My brother David has, and others have been quite successful in Britain. As you know, Britain changed the law so that only donors who are willing to be identifiable, egg and sperm, to their offspring when those become adult, only those are accepted. And that's, you know, they have that obligation. And I think that is the right way to go. You know, the usual idea is that there won't be any more sperm providers or egg providers. But that has shown not to be true. The number went up in Britain after they changed that law.
So apart from your efforts to try to remove the anonymity, which we know the jig is up because of DNA testing, what are your views on compensation? Should it just be a donation, or should it be compensated? Should we limit how many times a sperm donor can donate so we don't have thousands of children from one donor? Do you have other points of the perfect world in your mind?
Certainly the number should be limited. I mean, I don't really mind, but some of my siblings are saying, it's like you feel like you're a factory product coming up the assembly line. Some have felt it sort of oddly creepy to find people who are very similar, who you've never met. Some people are daunted by the number in our case. And there is something unnatural about it. Now, unnatural isn't necessarily bad, but it is strange. But there's other very good reasons to limit it. I mean, there's a lawsuit just now in Canada about half a dozen parents, half a dozen families are suing Zytex because the donor had some kind of motor neuron disease, which he didn't declare, or maybe he didn't know about it. I'm not quite sure. I think he knew about it, but I don't know. And anyway, he passed it on to some of the kids. And there's lots of cases like that. And sure, there's a small number compared to the large number of kids produced this way. But when you have a dozen kids, then the chances of passing something bad on are much, much higher. And of course, the sperm banks have lied. They've lied for years. They've lied about how many kids come from one sperm donor. One sperm donor is a very valuable commodity if he's a good, you know, a good specimen, you might say, a good eugenic. But he's popular, or you know, there's a guy in my movie who's tall, blonde, 6'2". He's a physician and a bodybuilder, and he's a lovely guy, and he was very much in demand. He might have 1,000 children. So that's but the sperm banks have not, partly through inattention and partly through dishonesty, because keeping proper records, keeping a proper registry, tracking everything year over year, those are all input costs, and they're profit-making business. So those are costs that they don't want. It's much better to just keep it all anonymous, sell the tissue as though it doesn't really belong to a human being. It's just a little thing that helps you have a baby. And thus, a great, you know, there's a guy in the recent film I just made, a doctor I interviewed, and I say, well, how about the records? You know, how about the records? Because you produced so many babies from this one guy, this physician donor who had 1,000 babies. And he said, well, there was a flood and it destroyed all the records, or some of the records. And that's very common, you know, this sort of talk. So there'd be no central registry. I don't know. In America, it's the worst. There's no central registry. There's no tracking. The FDA rejects any responsibility for oversight of the industry. It's entirely self-regulated.
One of my beefs is that birth certificates are just a sham. I mean, a birth certificate is a legal document that's supposed to record a birth. And exactly. So when it says mother and father or parent A or parent B, a lot of times that's meaningless. They're just one more layer of the lies.
I agree. And in fact, David, the brother I mentioned before, he is trying to get birth certificates, accurate birth certificates, done in the UK. I don't think there's a jurisdiction in the world that does that. There are quite a lot of jurisdictions, as your listeners probably know, where non-anonymous sperm and egg programs exist. I think Sweden was the first, and I think all the Nordic countries except Denmark, which has the biggest sperm bank in the world. Germany is non-anonymous. The Netherlands, I think Switzerland, I can't remember. The UK, Australia, Ireland, New Zealand. And of course, in the States, as you said, the jig is up. And a lot of sperm banks are no longer accepting anonymous donors because they've been promising it for years.
And it's my sense that intended parents like the anonymity. I mean, the donor can see people don't like it, but the parents, I don't know if it's still stigma around infertility or what, I don't know. But it still seems like the purchasers, the people who are buying the sperm, like anonymity.
Well, how do you measure that? What's the evidence for them liking anonymity?
I think because the clinics don't want to take donors that aren't willing to be anonymous. And I think they're...
What parents, like, research on that?
I know of no research, but I think, you know, because it is a business and their consumers are happy to buy anonymous sperm. Like if a clinic all of a sudden tomorrow said, we're only providing known donors, my sense is they're worried they'll lose business.
Well, that's possible.
Because the people who are coming there to shop want.
But of course, if there was a blanket law across the United States that you could only use identifiable donors, then they would come back. But I mean, there is no huge threat to the parental unit, because you don't necessarily have to bring, you know, an egg provider or a sperm provider into the family. That's just that the offspring, when they get old enough, for health reasons, for reasons of not wanting to, have a romantic affair with one of their siblings that they didn't realize was a sibling, which does happen. And just most of all for personal reasons, because you want to know who you come from. So, you know, like maybe the parents don't, but you know what, my feeling is that that's shifting, is that a lot of heterosexual parents recognize this. Now, of course, lesbian parents, it's pretty obvious, will be obvious to the child and most people how they got the baby. Not always, but usually they use a sperm provider. So that's not such a secret in the family.
Yeah.
It's and single mothers by choice, the same thing. Some, I think there is, the lesbians, the Sperm Bank of California, which was started by a lesbian group, you know, they've been wonderful. Although I wish they would only have identifiable donors. But also I think there's some feeling that, you know, maybe there was this movie, The Kids Are All Right.
Yeah.
This sort of fear fantasy about this guy who's going to come in, the sperm donor, and intrude upon the gay relationship.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was just like, yeah.
Mark Ruffalo played that guy.
Yeah, it was a bunch of, it was a fear fantasy. And that, so perhaps there are some in the lesbian community, or maybe for ideological reasons, because the idea of the father is a social construct, you know, if you're on the left, you know, your critical theory, you might think that. But anybody who's experienced, you know, not meeting somebody who's your, you know, your biological parent or your half siblings, or you know, like, I mean, if it was true that it didn't matter who your biological parent was, then it should also not matter when babies are accidentally swapped by a hospital at birth and sent to be raised by the wrong family, as happened recently in Newfoundland. Why does that matter? Doesn't matter because the biological connection doesn't mean anything. So
you told that story.
Why do people get upset about that?
You told that story when I was interviewing you for Anonymous Father's Day. And I remember it was at the very end of the shoot, you were about ready to leave. And then you said, oh, I want to tell one more story. And we had to re-mic you. And that was the story you talked about the couple. They were in a different country. The wife went into labor.
Yeah.
When they went to go home. No, we in this hospital, we just give you a baby. We don't give you your baby. You know, but that's okay. You'll love it.
That's a sort of a thought experiment invented by my brother David, who's getting a lot of mentions in this podcast. that was invented by him. But there was recently a real case in Newfoundland where two middle-aged men discovered they'd been raised by each other's families, and the Canadian public was like, oh my God, that's so sad, that's so awful. But if you can see it with them, and if you can see it with many people can now see it with adoptees. Of course, as you know, for years, adoptees were told, you should just be glad you got parents, you know, like that sort of thing. But now people recognize, and most adoptive parents recognize, I think, that, you know, maybe there's a real need. Not everybody wants to find out. And not every artificially conceived person sperm provider conceived, egg provider conceived person wants to know. Lots don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, probably about 75% or 80% do.
What are some of the things that our audience should know, like things not to say? You're at a cocktail party and you're just talking to somebody and you find out they're donor conceived. You know, you hear that, oh, aren't you so lucky? Wow, how cool. I mean, what are the things, you know, all the things that when your friend's just been diagnosed with cancer, you're not supposed to say, like, it'll be fine. You'll be okay. President Trump just stepped into that with COVID, with it's not so bad. Don't be afraid.
Right.
I mean, what are the things people say that you kind of cringe on the inside?
There's very little, actually, Jen. Okay. People are really sensitive. They think, oh, that's really interesting. And I don't usually like talking about in social situations because having 600 half siblings or however many I have, the hundreds, then people are like, oh, wow. And then they want to know more. So then I have to sort of tell the story, which is fine here. But, you know, one doesn't like to do it all the time. But I will say there's one thing. There's one thing journalists will say. Journalists will say this. They will say, who is your real father? And that is wrong. My real father was my father, the man who raised me. I would never dishonor him by suggesting he was anything other than my father. Mm-hmm. But that's important.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't pin you down. Are you okay with donors being paid?
I was hoping to avoid the question, but clearly not. So you're too good an interviewer. I would say this, that the majority of donor-conceived organizations, I believe, do not. I'm not sure about We Are Donor-Conceived in the States, but elsewhere, here and in the UK and Australia, there's a very strong feeling that they shouldn't be paid, that the feeling is, you know, you don't want to feel like this person, you know, did this for money. I'm not particularly personally bothered by it. The guy who my biological father, BP Wiesner, was a fascinating guy, but he was a little, he was sometimes a little short on the ethics. And, He wasn't paid, but his, you know, the family practice was making money off this. So you could regard him as paid. So it's not that, I think it'd be better if it were a gift system. I think our whole culture would be better off if there was a little bit less commercialization of everything. And when you start commercializing human tissue, selling kidneys, whatever, well, a lot of problems can creep in. And of course, if you're motivating guys to lie because they want to make a bit of money by selling their sperm, well, just right in the language, it's very hard to avoid the word donor, but of course it's a lie. That's not entirely true. In Britain now it is, you know, altruistic, supposedly, expenses on it. But mostly they're vendors. They're egg vendors. They're egg sellers. They're sperm sellers. And we're trapped into this word donor, which, because nobody wants to feel like it's you're a product of a commercial transaction.
Yeah,
but we do this. My personal feeling is I don't really care that much.
Okay.
But I have to acknowledge that's a minority position.
Yeah. Well, and I respect that. But yeah, there are people that are troubled by knowing that some guy was paid $150, you know, to do something in a room with a magazine, whatever. But not everybody is that way. So what do you have any thoughts on, you know, because I work in the space of egg donation too, donation in quotes. Yeah. And, you know, egg donation certainly is more risky. It's a more onerous, you know, endeavor than to get a sperm specimen. But the situation is the same for the people who produce the products of the egg or sperm donation. Do you still want no anonymity, you know, restrictions on the number of times women can sell their eggs? They have to be known donors.
Well, certainly. Egg providers should be also under the same rules, where eventually they can be identified by the offspring. That's not to say, by the way, that there's some sort of obligation for a relationship. I don't think no two adults in a free country have an obligation to have a relationship, and there's certainly no financial obligation. But the information, I think, belongs to the offspring. The fact is that you can put it in a sort of a, some people say, oh, well, lots of people are mistaken as to their true parent, you know, their true father. They say 30%. It's not, it's about less than 5%. But people say that all the time. And the thing is that just because that does happen with people, I mean, you might as well say, oh, lots of babies are born blind. So why don't we just blind you when you're born? You know? Obviously, it's not the same thing. Something happens by accident. That's not the standard of care. That's not the standard you aim for. But it's, I would put it slightly this way, is that nobody has the right to withhold or deprive citizens of essential information about their life and about their story. You know, you don't have the right to participate in a lie. Like if I've got an envelope on my desk and you're sitting in front of me, and in that envelope is your biological father who you didn't know, and you say, "Oh, really?" And I say, "I'm sorry, you can't have that. You can't have the knowledge of who he was medically, genetically, who his ancestors were. You can't have the knowledge of who he is. You can't see his photograph. You can't know his name. You can't have his address. Sorry, I'm putting it back in this safe and get out of my office." Well, that's more or less the situation. And I think that's wrong.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think so too. Well, we're just about the end of our time, but I want people to know how or where they can go to see Offspring or your newest film, The World's Biggest Family.
Well, The World's Biggest Family was made by the CBC, which is the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And it's public broadcast in this country. And it's geo-blocked here. I mean, it's geo-blocked for people outside Canada. For people inside Canada, go to CBC Gem and look for The World's Biggest Family, and you will find it. If you're outside of Canada, it's quite very recent, this film, just a few weeks ago, and I'm trying to get a distributor, or I have a distributor, and they're trying to market the film in the United States. So maybe when that's done, and in other countries, but maybe when that's done, I will let you know, and you can maybe put a note in. As far as Offspring goes, well, that's also, you know, it's handled by a distributor, but it's kind of finished its run.
Are there any other films out there that you would recommend in this space that you and I didn't make? I'm trying to think. I mean, not the Kids Are All Right, Starbuck,
No. Starbuck isn't bad. The Quebec version, I've never seen the American version. The French version is good. Yeah, there are a couple. There was a film a long time ago, which is how I met David, called Secret Fathers, which is about the process back in the day in England. But that's old. That's in the 90s. There's that one, what's it called? My secret. Oh, it's about the guy living in a trailer in California.
Oh, yeah. And like the VW bus.
Yeah.
I know the film. I can't remember the name, though. I can see the graphic. It was a great graphic.
We Are Donna Conceived website has quite a few films on there.
Good.
And there's so many YouTube videos about people finding out and finding their siblings.
Yeah. And, you know, there's...
I'll send you a copy of World's Biggest Family, but you can't, unfortunately, you can't share that one yet.
Yeah, no, I won't. A review
copy, if you like.
Yeah, there you go. Very good. All right, my friend. Well, this has just been delightful to reconnect with you after all these years and to learn more.
Yes, great. Thank you for everything and for keeping these matters alive and in the public mind.
Well, while I still have breath in my lungs.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too. And join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.